podcast for Fair Higher Education, and our first one with Michael Biggs, a sociology professor at Oxford, and Rachel Auer, a conceptual artist, as I understand you. If you can tell us a bit more about what that is, Rachel, just to kick us off.
Well, being a conceptual artist, thoroughly useless, I think, given the light of what's happening in the world at the moment. It's quite interesting. I sort of made debating the sort of use of art. But I mean, basically, it's more idea-driven art.
Okay.
So it can manifest itself anyway. So it ends up in film, sculpture, whatever. But it's sort of like the ideas behind it are stronger, I guess, than the aesthetic.
Okay, I understand. So is that like more like the way it comes through in a kind of performance, I suppose?
Not really. I mean, any sort of medium, in a sense.
Okay.
So, I mean, it could just be I'm just trying to think. I mean, like Duchamp was the instigator, wasn't he, of conceptual art with the urinal?
Yeah.
The ready-made, which he stole off a woman.
I'm guessing you're having quite a lot of your shows cancelled at the moment.
Well, I think they've pretty much all been cancelled after no platforming.
It's impossible, yeah.
So it's kind of like the whole world has been no platform now.
Michael, just for our audience, what's your kind of specialism, so to speak?
So I do work on research on collective protest and social movements. So I've done research on the labor movement, on the civil rights movement in America, other things like the London riot of 2011. So a whole variety of different types of protests over the last century and a half.
Okay. So we're here to talk about the consequences of speaking out, as it were, on the sex and gender debate. Do either one of you want to kick off by spelling out your position, so to speak, that you perceive has gotten you into some trouble within your institution? And Rachel, you had the incident at Oxford that we'll get to. So do you want to kick us off there, Michael?
Sure. You mean what do my beliefs that are so controversial?
What's perceived to be so troublesome for other people?
I think I have exactly the same position on this issue as 95% of the population, which is, I think that there's differences between males and females. I think that sexual orientation is based on sex. I don't think that a man becomes a woman just by putting on some lipstick and a dress, female pronouns. So I think I think I'm very conventional in that sense. I think I'm perhaps less conventional in the sense that I'm quite happy with people. I think it's great if people play around with gender. If if a man puts on lipstick and a dress, I think that's great. That's kind of, Boy George was one of the icons of my childhood. So I think playing around with gender is great, and gender blending and fluidity and all that is wonderful. But I think that sex is real, and that there are certain things that must be based on sex rather than self-proclaimed or self-identified gender.
Yeah, so it's like, in the 80s, it's now controversial, isn't it? You know, you had Adam Ant and Boy George and
Grace Jones.
I was slightly young, so,
Grace Jones, I remember as well, as an incredibly masculine-looking woman, but it was very clear that she was a woman, and we all admired her as a kind of path-breaking woman. So I suppose I was in the 1990s when I was in graduate school in America, I was got involved just a little bit in the transgender politics, and I was took a very pro-trans side of things. And I saw all the great figures of trans activism like Leslie Feinberg. Went along to hear them talk. I went to the first female to male transsexual, as they were known then, conference in Boston. So I was very engaged in that in the 1990s, and I thought it was very progressive. And then I lost touch with that. And when I came to realize the transgender claims were about 3 years ago, I then sort of quickly, well, I began to look into it a bit more, and I quickly reversed my position, and I thought, actually, this is something that's not very progressive at all.
It's quite progressive. I mean, I didn't understand until about, I would say about the same time as you, 2 to 3 years ago, that I believe we were talking about transsexual people. I didn't realize that we were speaking about people who reported a feeling of feeling like a man or a woman or non-binary or something else. I didn't understand that was becoming the mainstream, and we were invited to accept that that was actually made somebody objectively the case, you know. I didn't understand that was being taken seriously, and it dawns on you slowly. Rachel, is this kind of mirror your experience?
Yes, absolutely. Basically, what Michael says, I think it just mirrors my experience totally. I mean, I came out as gay in the early 80s, and I spent a lot of time on the gay scene. I mean, I dressed as a man a lot. I used to go to men's clubs, dressed as a man, still loads of photos.
Did you use the label Butch?
Did I use to what?
The label Butch, as it were.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yes. Well, hopefully I still am. to be honest, I never really thought much of it. Everyone sort of mixed together. You know, over the years, I've seen friends. I mean, some friends who've transitioned, and I just never thought anything of it. I just thought, oh, okay, fine. And I think this all became clear about 4 years ago when I was invited to be in an exhibition called Queering Minimalism, which I assumed was with gay artists. And I thought, oh, how nice to be showing with a bunch of gay artists. Because you've all got similar concerns, in a sense. So it's quite relaxing when you're with other gay people. And then I realised that they weren't gay. And I didn't understand why they're calling themselves queer if they're not gay, because they're two totally different things. And I think then someone explained the sort of queer theory to me. And it was sort of a light bulb went off. And I thought, oh, this is just totally bonkers. it's like straight people have appropriated your culture. That's what's so weird. And in a way, they're silencing you, straight people.
They are. And it's just insulting to everybody. I have an aversion to the word queer now, I'm afraid.
I think most gay people do. There was a report, wasn't it? 90% of gay men hated the word queer.
Yeah.
I mean, when I was brought up, when I was young, it was illegal. I was brought up in Jersey. You know, so I remember people going to prison.
Wow, really? So people were going to prison. Was this like, you know, gay men being arrested for, you know...
Their partners, for kissing, or just having a shag in the car or something, you know? Nothing sort of major. But I think, Jersey tends to be quite behind the times anyway.
They're like a time warp on the island.
It is like a time warp, yes.
Time warp on the island, yeah. So how did these kind of what seem to be perfectly common sense reality-based views start to cause trouble for you within an academic context? And Michael, I'm aware that there was some controversy over a Twitter account that you had, and there was a newspaper article. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what happened there?
Sure. Yes. Well, there was a supposed claims that I was associated with a particular Twitter account, which wasn't a very controversial Twitter account, as far as I can gather. It was merely sort of repeating and providing some gender critical information and engaging in sort of the usual sort of debate that one finds on Twitter, but. There were some claims in the student newspaper that this account was mine. And as a result, that you know, I was on the front page, I think, a couple of times in the student newspaper. And I have to say that my department was actually pretty good about things and is obviously aware of the importance of academic freedom. I did lose, one doctoral student decided that she didn't want to work with me anymore, but that's her choice, and that's fine. There were other things that were perhaps less pleasant, so the student newspaper actually rang up one of my doctoral students and sort of asked them, how does it feel to have a transphobe as a supervisor? So I thought that was pretty, I think you know, if a student newspaper comments on a faculty member's views, then that's fine. But to try to kind of destroy the relationship between the supervisor and a student is what they're trying to do. Trying to sort of get them to denounce me, I thought was pretty. That was pretty unethical, I thought.
I think that's an unacceptable invasion of your academic life and your students' boundaries.
Exactly.
That's a conversation to have between friends. It's not something you should just invade somebody's email inbox with, or phone them about.
Exactly.
Did that have an impact on your doctoral student? Did they stay with you?
Yes. So one left me, but the others stayed. Yeah. And then I think more recently, I was featured actually last in autumn. I was featured twice on something I'd written for Quillette. Was featured on the front page of the student newspaper twice, in two weeks in a row. And then somebody in our department made multiple photocopies of that and circulated it throughout the building, so that everybody could see just exactly what quotes of mine from this Quillette article were about.
There's a sense of, if you've been put on trial here by students in your department and possibly expecting your college to capitulate, and exorcise you from the building, has some kind of evil transfer, is the sense that I am getting.
I think some of the students who are particularly angry were Americans, and I think they expected that I would be, that I would be either so ashamed or so embarrassed, or that my colleagues, like you're saying, would be so outraged that I would, suffer some more serious consequence. But I think they miss. I think Oxford is quite an old-fashioned place, which has its disadvantages, but it also has its advantages in the sense that there are people who really believe in academic freedom. And also, once they saw my views, they just thought, well, these views are not outrageous. This is not some terrible, despicable, discriminatory thing that he's doing. And I should say that what I particularly found objectionable in the sort of allegations that are made against me with trans students would not feel safe with me. But of course, I would never discriminate against somebody on whether they're trans or depending on their sexual orientation or their race or whatever. And I've always made that very clear that I would never discriminate. And that, you don't have to accept somebody's beliefs in order to teach them and mark them fairly, right? I mean, if I had a student who was a Muslim or a Scientologist or a Christian,
I mean, you're there to teach a subject and you're there to make an assessment of their work in the teaching capacity. So, you're going to have a whole range of different views which are just completely irrelevant to that. It's like some student being outraged because you voted, leave or remain, some other political view that they disagree with. But when you say that your department were supportive, what about the wider, university? Because I know you said to me you tried to make a subject access request, and because you thought there may have been some wider concern within the university and you wanted to try and find out what that was, but you didn't get very far with that, as I understand it.
Yeah, I think that might have just been the university's policy on personal information. But I think that within the university, I think most people are very much on sort of my way of thinking, or at least think that the way we think is quite a legitimate perspective to have. I think the Equality and Diversity Unit within the university has its own particular ideology, which it wants to, it feels that it should, that should be the kind of doctrine which everybody has to sign up to. And so myself and a few other academics in Oxford have been sort of having a little bit of a tussle with the Equality and Diversity Unit as to what is appropriate, for example, as a transgender policy, or what is appropriate, whether they should be allowed to misrepresent the Equality Act in their materials, which fortunately we won that case. But we weren't able, for example, to convince them that homosexuality was something that should be recognized by the Equality and Diversity. So that move to the Stonewall, you know, our trans guidance talks, you know, says that, you know, it's all about saying sexual orientation is not about sex. It's not about the sex of the person you're attracted to. It's about the gender identity of the person you're attracted to.
No. So, you were getting that support from your department, and it's interesting because, Rachel, when you were invited to speak at Oxford Brookes, you had a very different experience, didn't you? So you were initially invited to speak, and then what happened with the organisers and the department?
I prepared my talk, and the night before, I got an email from the person who organised it to say, there was this Twitter account called Turfs Out of Art who were saying that I was a turf and dangerous, and for people to pick up on this tweet and report me to the university or stop me speaking, and something about safe spaces and just all that rubbish, basically.
And that was literally the night before.
So it was the night before. And to be honest, I've not been that active in Twitter. I'd liked a couple of tweets. I mean, one by the LGB Alliance. I think that's the one they quoted.
Wow.
And and then in the morning, just before I was about to leave, I was told it had all blown up at Oxford Brookes, and that it's going to have to be postponed.
And so it was like what happened with Selena Todd, when you were just given a couple of hours notice and you had presumably made arrangements and, you know, you're the practical arrangements.
Oh, yes. And I'd written the talk and I made practical arrangements and I was just about to leave the house. But then their official line was that it was a booking error, or they hadn't followed the right booking procedures. So I'm doing a subject access request, but they're trying to delay it. They keep delaying it. I'm sure that will show some sort of juicy emails that they're telling porcupines, which they obviously are.
There's no booking error. Booking errors don't happen with academic talks. I've never seen one happen in a decade of going to them.
Oh, well, and I had one. I had one about a month later, booking errors. I seem to incur booking errors now.
After that cancellation, did you have anyone express private support for you? Like Michael has had support from his colleagues.
Not really, because an artist is quite a solitary business, and I'm not represented, so I'm by my own. But I think I was talking a bit to, is it Kathleen Stock? I mean, she was brilliant. So that was a bit of normality, I guess. She was quite supportive.
Uh-huh.
And the Twitter community that I hadn't engaged with that much were very, very supportive, so that was nice. So it stops you going mad, because you think, well...
We're just normal. Yeah.
And you were supportive as well, and I didn't know you before, so it was just people saying nice things.
You feel like you're being gaslit about what's reality. So
what is so stupid? I mean, I was trying to explain it to my parents. It's so absolutely ridiculous. You can't explain it to anyone.
No,
they just think you're making it up if you're outside. And of course, I didn't understand the term gender critical. I'd never heard of these words. I'm not an academic, and I'm not in academia. So
that doesn't matter, though, does it? It's just common sense. I mean, when I found out about it, I found out because was in philosophy, I came across Rachel McKinnon, and I genuinely believe that Rachel McKinnon was a philosophy thought experiment designed, you know, make us all think what on earth was going on. And over a period of a few months, it dawned on me that Rachel McKinnon was not a plant, but a real person with, you know, who thought that you could become a woman by the power of thought. But you took action, didn't you? What was that? What did that involve?
Because
there was that Challenge University campaign. So do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
I'll just say before about support, the most supportive people were actually my trans friends. And they were really supportive on Twitter, which is what the world doesn't want to know, that trans, you know, a lot of trans people think the same as I do. So I must thank them for that.
Are these people, do they consider themselves transsexual?
Yes. Trans people. And they were really supportive, whereas the art world goes very quiet because the art world has to be on message, you know. And I don't know, they shied away a bit. So sort of normal friends outside the art world were supportive. You lot on Twitter were great, and trans friends were really supportive. So then, yeah, I got in touch with Kathleen Stock and a lawyer at that time. And then they sort of put together the University Challenge thing, which was really to do a crowdfunder just to send a very stiff letter to the university, because it's ridiculous that they were sort of made to sort of postpone me just because I like one frigging tweet or two.
And which, from my experience, those letters can cost quite a lot of money. So, you know, and then they re-invited you, didn't they? So you're going back to speak when?
Well, I did, but it's all gone pear-shaped because of the virus.
COVID, yeah.
So I think it was meant to be in a couple of days' time.
Yes,
but in terms of raising the money, I mean, literally within a couple of days, I'd raised sort of like just 10, which was enough to write the initial letters.
Is there any kind of Skypey or video facility through which this may be done? Or is it really the kind of thing that requires, you know, you being in a room with people?
Well, the lecture.
Yeah, this talk, that's obviously, that can't happen in person.
Oh no, I mean, it could be done through Skype. I mean, the fact is the talk was very uninteresting. It was an artist talk, and I was talking about my work that is relatively feminist, you know, and sculptural. There was nothing that anyone could really take issue with. Well, generally, men tend to take issue because I have a bit of a go at them, but, you know.
I think if somebody's going as far as to look at what tweets you're liking, that's somebody going to look for offence.
Yes, it was something to do with offence. I mean, everyone said it's nothing to do with the trans community. People are leveraging this for their own purposes.
For their
yes, agenda. I mean, they reckon in my case, potentially, there's this one bloke we particularly know who's just a particularly jealous male artist, and we think he initiated this for his own purpose. And the thing is, it's straight people doing this.
You know, it's not just your professional consequences, but the invasion of your personal life, it just completely takes over.
Yes.
At least it did with me. So a question for both of you in the last half. Why do you think this is going on so much? Just cancel culture and the no platforming we have, the complaints to universities. What, in your view, is the kind of main factor that's motivating that?
Yeah, I mean, I think partly if you do, once this gets established, this idea that you can attack people or criticize people for having the wrong opinions around gender, for example, it does empower people to then, let's say students can now effectively exercise power over professors or over teachers. And likewise, you know, within a jealous artist could, somebody, you know, rivalries among artists can then be played out because it's a good way of attacking your enemy, as Rachel was saying. So I think once you do have this ideology where you can say, well, this person's a phobe of some sort, this person has violated some sort of basic morality, it does, you do get a lot of people who are not really genuinely concerned about the issue, but they rather are using this in order to exercise power that they couldn't normally exercise. Because normally, of course, if you're a professor or an academic, you have more power than the students, but now they've got a little leverage where they can actually exercise or attempt to exercise power over you. So I think it does bring out the worst, or sometimes, you know, obviously in some cases people are genuinely concerned about these issues, but in other cases they're just enjoying the power it gives them.
Yes, I don't even think they understand these issues. And what makes me so mad is people outside the gay community just stirring it up. They know nothing. You know, and I mean, I think I've even been called a homophobe. I mean, it's a joke.
You called a homophobe. Calling a lesbian homophobe, you know, that's a contradiction by definition.
Well, and that's another issue. Why is it predominantly women? It's predominantly women who've been targeted.
I mean, that's a question I was thinking of, Michael. Would you say, you know, when you see some of the things that are happening to some of the other academics, would you say you are getting off lightly?
Yes, I'd say so. I think that's partly the fact that I'm a man. It may also be partly the kind of circles that I move in, because the kind of sociology I do is really not very woke, and so there can't be, you know, the sort of my friends and my colleagues are not as woke as it could be in some other areas of sociology or some other areas of academia. But I do think we have to acknowledge that it's not just it's women who are also doing the targeting. And as far as I can tell, we know that the people who are most pro-trans, and we know from survey evidence, tend to be women, young women. And it's really young women, and I've experienced this personally myself, is it's really young women, usually who aren't trans and usually who aren't lesbian, or in some cases they are, who are doing this and who are kind of really taking up the cause of trans as being the most sort of most precious and the most important cause that they can imagine.
No, so I do agree with that, but and it's interesting why they are targeting women, because it's usually middle-aged women that are exactly being the targets, and they're the ones you've got to hide from, have these safe spaces, you know.
Yes, exactly.
I think the perception is that we are safe targets. We will not fight back. And they have an issue that seems to be progressive. And as Michael said, they are now exercising power, and partly because of the way that universities are now becoming run like supermarkets, basically. And, you know, there's the commercialization of higher education, and students feel that they have this power, that they can say what their lecturers should and shouldn't even be thinking, or at least the way that they express themselves on social media. And they have the ability to control that. And, you know, you're expected to be disciplined and sanctioned for your views.
But it's almost like these people, I mean, these young women who are sort of like, I don't know, you know, the trans activists, it's almost like the Stepford Wives. I mean, they just have set sentences. It's as if they're not even thinking themselves. So it's like, yeah, in a sense, they're being weaponized, you know, that, you know, just pick a lot of not very bright students. Do you know what I mean? Feed them with sentences and then send them off.
It's probably an automated generator somewhere for these complaints that you can use.
I think there's probably a list of about three of them.
but seriously.
Yeah, I think it is and when you look at the protests, the way that they chant these slogans, it is quite scary, isn't it? Because they're these kind of meaningless slogans like trans women are women, or, you know, these non-binary is valid. And they don't really mean anything. But the fact that they're willing to chant them so repetitively for quite a long time, maybe up to an hour or a couple, over an hour.
Slogan that puts you in a box, though, and it makes it very difficult to challenge, because, you know, once you put phobe on the end of something, it just has this chilling effect, and it silences you.
Well, it did, doesn't now. It just makes me so bloody annoyed. I mean,
what's been the effect on you both? Would you say, for me, I know that there were significant personal effects, and, you know, it's still going on and it's taken over. And to find yourself sitting in a room with a solicitor because somebody has objected to liking what you like on Twitter is absolutely insane. I didn't give it a second thought. I'm going through and I'm seeing posts and I'm liking. It genuinely didn't occur to me that somebody would write a letter and say, on the basis of this, Louise Moody is a safeguarding risk. So you know, this is a situation we're in, and it just makes you feel like you're going insane. That maybe you're the wrong one.
But doesn't that wear off after a while? I must admit, when it first happened to me, I think you have a month where you do feel very low and you feel it's you and blah blah blah, but when you speaking to sort of rational people around, and you know, that sort of then brings you up, and I haven't really gone back there again. But maybe you've had more happen to you.
what do you think about going forward, though? Do you think that these you know, this media storm that you've been in to some degree, to both of you, do you think that's going to harm you professionally going forward?
In my point of view, it's totally harmed me. People will not go near me in the art world. I've had commissions cancelled, although no one will say it's directly. I have no talks anymore. Do you know what I mean? So it's completely damaged my reputation. But in a sense, I mean, do I care? I did.
You did.
I did, but I mean, you know, and it's even someone the other day was, I'm speaking to a curator who's going to work with me. They Googled me. So you saw I was the biggest transphobe and homophobe, and now they don't want to work.
Wow. What did they cite that as a reason?
Yes. And it's very interesting. They thought it'd be dangerous because they work with queer and non-binary artists. I mean, what the fuck do they think I am? Do you know what I mean? And then this is a straight person.
It's like you're being excluded from your own community.
Yes. Yeah, but the community did get a bit muddled, let's face it, over the last few years.
Community, yeah.
I mean, it is inclusive of everyone. It's not it's only exclusive of sort of, you know, white heterosexual males, really, isn't it? Well, they probably come in the kink path, but you don't want me to get me on that one. But yes, I mean, it is completely damaging. And I guess because I'm older, do I care so much? No.
What's the situation for you, Michael? Are you just able to get on with your kind of research and just kind of compartmentalize this, and, you know, it doesn't really affect your professional life? What's the situation? Are you still getting invited to give talks and so forth? Because we sort of...
I was disinvited. I mean, it's hard to know when you're being disinvited. I know I was disinvited by the sociology department in Norway, who invited me and then sort of uninvited me. Otherwise, it's hard to say. I mean, I'm very fortunate because I'm in a tenured position. Then in some ways, I'm much harder to sort of sanction. And that's why I spoke out quite so strongly, because, of course, I know that I'm safe. And I've got in some ways, I'm in a privileged position. And it's important to use that if you think there's important principles at stake. But I do think at the personal level, it certainly is, you know, most of us don't want to be hated and viewed as this kind of evil person by students. After all, we want students to like us or sort of respect us. But I think once you get over it, I think once you kind of realize, you just think, well, I have these principles and I've thought really hard about this. It's not something that I've done lightly. And I think this is really important, and I'm willing to, you know, if people call me, you know, want to call me an evil bigot, or in my case, they said that I was like Steve Bannon, the American far right Trump guy. You know, if they want to say that, then that's up to them. I mean, it's on them, and I don't really care. I've lost a few friends from this, but I mean, ultimately, I think I'm right. I'm standing up for the right principles. So, you know, and once you've kind of been labeled a disgusting bigot and a transphobe, then you sort of say, okay, well, you know, what more can they do to
well, that's true. Yeah, and I think as a woman as well, I mean, as a gay woman as well, you've had this experience of like the misogyny and the homophobia anyway, so you're well trained at people hating you. So this is just, you know, another step. And to be honest, out of this, I've actually made a lot more friends, and I haven't lost any. Yeah. Oh, one, but I was kind of pleased about that. But yes. So, I mean, you know, it has been a very positive experience as well. And then saying that, there's a lot of gender critical young artists who are now approaching me about things. So that's been very positive.
Okay, that's good, isn't it? I always feel odd when I hear the word gender critical now. That was the phrase I used to use when I came into this debate. I just, you know, we are just upholding reality. At the core of all this, we are upholding reality. We are not believing in what I would call Cartesian superstition, where you think a feeling in the head can actually make somebody, you know, what a man or a woman or whatever they think they are. I mean, for me, that's the whole core of it. What do you think? How do you think we might improve things going forward? Because the situation seems to be getting worse. We've had Kathleen Stockton non-platformed at the University of East Anglia, I believe. Obviously, there's no events going on at the moment. We're in the middle of the play. But the situation seems to be getting more worse and worse. We had the cancellation of the Four Women Scots event at Edinburgh. There was the assault of Julie Bindle. So, you know, things need to change and things need to improve when, you know, life gets back to normal after this plague. How do you think that we can challenge things constructively and actually make progress here? Because it feels like we're fighting a war.
So I think that I actually think that the very fact that people were being no-platformed with increasing numbers shows that the conflict was becoming more and more widely known. And I think that more widely, more public, the more people get to know what's at stake in this debate, the more we're winning. In some sense, I think transgender activists, trans activists, really won in so made so much progress because nobody was paying attention. I think when people pay attention, then the logic and the force of our arguments are inevitably going to win. So in some ways, I think the more conflict there is, the more we're winning. Whereas it's precisely when nothing was, you know, nobody was being the platform, that was when the detrimental policies were being implemented. So I think in Britain, at least, we really had massive momentum in the 6 months or a year
there really is huge public support. I mean, Eva Powen ended up on the front page of the Daily Mail, as you know.
Oh, did she?
Student complained about her tweets. And the response was overwhelming, you know. She had needed universal support. So, you know, I think you're right. Give daylight to these views.
Exactly.
So that, you know, the public can see what's going on within academia.
And I think, people keep talking because there is a real world outside academia and outside the art world. And I think the real world are quite reasonable. It's just this bubble in the art world and academia.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the idea that we're all kind of huddled in rooms talking about obscure things, I think that's a bit of a...
I think the general thing is just to keep talking, and I just keep talking about it. And, I mean, people are afraid to talk about it. It's nuts. But just to keep talking.
And keep getting the word out there and try not to get ourselves banned from social media.
And doing it in different ways. I mean, people like Julie Bindle and Kathleen Stock and you are just doing, you know, amazing jobs. And I just think, you know, different people are going to appeal to different people. So just to keep, talking.
That's very true. And that's very kind of you to say. I'm obviously kind of have a different voice now. I got evicted from York. And, you know, it's fine. Like you say, it's coming good in the end. I'm involved with Fair Hedgie, as you know, we're doing his podcast. So I'm going to wrap it up unless there are any other comments or observations you want to make in the last, you know, few minutes.
I think it might be worth thinking about how the current sort of pandemic is going to influence things, because as I said, I think that really we had massive momentum in Britain, and that was really made Britain very different from countries like America and Canada. And yet, of course, all that momentum has now sort of been dissipated because the general public and politicians and universities are not going to focus on that while there are so many other problems and crises stemming from the epidemic. So I think that in some sense, a truce in the conflict over gender is inevitable. I think what happens after that, when things sort of gradually return to normal, is I wonder whether given the kind of the deaths that will unfortunately and tragically happen because of the epidemic, and given the economic the really severe economic damage, will there be so much, some of the transgender claims seem rather frivolous by the light of these really serious events. And also, in some ways, this virus is a reminder that biology matters, right? This is virus is something that happens because of evolution. And
Also in the fact that it's affecting more men as well. So sex matters.
Exactly.
And sex matters
exactly,
when gathering stats. So I just really, well, one would hope it would just be dismissed as nonsense.
I think the preliminary statistics that I'm seeing are that it seems to affect roughly twice the number of men disproportionately in terms of severity. So, you know, it's not just a few percentage points
it's quite significant.
Star factors. This is a whacking great big gap that seems to have a biological basis that, you know, will be discovered. So it doesn't matter what you're thinking, you know, gender identity is kind of irrelevant once the plague gets you, isn't it? I think you're absolutely right. And I also think there's a sense for everyone's just going to be shell-shocked. I certainly am. You know, we are in a very surreal situation. I've only been going outside to walk the dogs, and I just feel absolutely shell-shocked by it all. And I think, you know, as you say, when things gradually get back to normal, people are not going to be thinking so much on these issues. And it's not going to be, do we need safe spaces? Do we need to worry what somebody liked on Twitter? Like you say, it is frivolous. But the
thing is, it was frivolous before as well. I still can't get my head around why we're even debating this.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean?
No, we have walked into a parallel universe, certainly. It does. It just feels like you're stating the obvious. The fact that we have to stand up and state the obvious, and it is seen as controversial for doing so, is baffling. It's baffling.
It is baffling.
It is baffling.
We're all baffled now.
And thank you both for your time so much.
Thank you for listening. That concludes my chat with Michael. I'm Rachel, and we'll be back soon. Thank you.